Welcome. This is Sherilyn Parsons, founder and director of the Bay Area Book Festival. Enjoy the conversation.
Good afternoon, everybody. Thank you for coming to Writing Ireland at the Bay Area Book Festival. My name is Rosemary Graham. I'll be the moderator for today's session. I'm very excited and happy to be welcoming these three wonderful Irish writers today and to engage them in conversation about writing and Ireland and their wonderful books. I first need to thank Culture Ireland, which has sponsored this event and helped to get these writers here to Berkeley. Also, I wanted to put in a thank you for Culture Ireland Bay Area. If you are not familiar with that organization, I don't know if Catherine Barry is here. But for those of you who are interested in Irish literature, you'll want to know about that organization. And keep in mind that in October, there's a wonderful Irish Writers Week that Culture Ireland Bay Area puts on. It's the Los Gatos Listol Writers Week. Mike has been there before, yes. And it's a whole week of wonderful writers and poets from Ireland, so you'll want to. And Catherine told me they now have an app. There's a Irish Culture Bay Area app that you can download for your phone, and so anything related to Ireland in the Bay Area you can know about through your phone. So let me get started. I'm going to introduce each of our writers one at a time and ask them to read a little bit from the books that they are here with today. They all have more than one book, but I'm going to go one at a time for that and then start with our questions. And I'm going to first introduce you to Mike McCormick, who's, yes. Mike's most recent and most celebrated book is Solar Bones, which was published in 2016. That novel is the winner of, among others, the 2018 Dublin Literary Award, the 2016 Goldsmiths Prize, and the Irish Book Awards Novel of the Year. He is the author of two collections of short fiction, Getting It in the Head and Forensic Songs, and two other novels, Notes from a Coma and Crow's Requiem. Mike and his family have been in the U.S. for this last half year as he was named the 2019 Charles Heimbold, is that how we say that? Chair of Irish Studies at Villanova University. So lucky students in Philadelphia have been studying Irish literature with Mike. He teaches back home in Ireland. He teaches at NUI Galway, the National University of Ireland and Galway. And Mike will read a little bit from... So I'm not sure about my microphone use if I'm...
Can you hear me? No. Okay. All right, can you hear me now? Okay, good. Thank you. Thank you all for coming, and thank you to the festival for the invitation. I'm going to read a page and a half from Solar Bones, and in this page we have our protagonist, Marcus Conway. He's just after leaving off Skyping his son in Australia, and this part is this bit here, this passage here, it kind of explains the title Solar Bones that I'm asked about sometimes. And he said, I watched the screen cloud to a fizzy interference as it shut down, leaving the room in dark silence and that burnt feeling behind my eyes, as if the light from the monitor had scalded them to the core. The same feeling you imagine you'd have just before the world goes up in flames, some refined corrosion eaten away at the rods and cones, collapsing their internal structure before they slope out of their sockets.
Can you hold the mic closer?
Can you hear it? Can you hear it now? Okay. Rods and cones collapsing their internal structure before they slope out of their sockets and run down their cheekbones, leaving you standing hollow-eyed in the middle of some desolation with the wind whistling through your skull. Just before the world collapses, mountains, rivers and lakes, acres, roots and perches into oblivion, drawn down into that fissure in creation where everything is consumed in raging tides and swells of non-being, the physical world gone down in flames, mountains, rivers, and lakes, and pulling with it also all those human rhythms that bind us together and draw the world into a community. those daily rites, rhythms, and rituals upholding the world like solar bones, that rarefied amalgam of time and light whose extension through every minute of the day is visible from the moment I get up in the morning and stand at the kitchen window with a mug of tea in my hand and watch the first cars of the day passing on the road, every one of them known to me, name, number plate, and destination, one after another, beginning at 7:30 with Frances Dugan in a green Megane, off to her job as a receptionist in the Clue Bay Hotel. And Sarah Moran going in the opposite direction to begin her 8:00 shift in Allergan. And Mark Ruddy in an 07 Pajero returning from the night shift in Baxter. And the school bus going back to collect the kids from the furthest edge of the parish. And marching through in a green post van followed by Shamie Moran in the milk lorry. 7,000 litres of milk sloshing around in the tank behind his head. And then Jimmy Lyons behind him in a blue Passat. In 30 minutes, he will throw open the gates of the builder's yard on the Kilgeaver Road.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mike. Emily Pine is a scholar who has published widely on the subjects of contemporary drama and memory studies. She is associate professor in modern drama at UCD, University College Dublin, and is director of the Irish Memory Studies Research Network. This spring, her wildly successful essay collection, Notes to Self, will be published in the U.S. by Dial Press. In 2018, it was named the Irish Book of the Year, and among other prizes. I was in Dublin this past January, and I thought I had my chance to get a hold of a copy of Notes to Self, and I could not find one. I went to two Eason's, which is their big chain of bookstores, and I went to the Winding Stair, which is a lovely independent bookstore, and everyone was out because that's how popular this book was, which we congratulate Emily for. So we're excited that it's coming out in the U.S. and that we have actually some special copies available here in advance of publication. Emily, would you introduce us to your to your collection?
Thank you. Thank you so much, and thank you for the invitation to be here. I was a student here 20 years ago at Berkeley, and so it's lovely to come back in another guise, as kind of, you know, with a mask on as a writer. This collection is nonfiction, and I began to write it because in 2013, my father, who had been an alcoholic all my life, went into liver failure. And really the beginning of the book was me trying to come to terms with and trying to record what that felt like, the emotions and the very, very complicated, messy emotions that are provoked by having an alcoholic in your family. So this is from the first essay. When I was 10 years old, Dad left us in a pub. He was angry because I hadn't stopped my 5-year-old sister from pouring her orange squash into his gin and tonic. He drove away, and he did not come back for us. We found someone else to give us dinner. We found someone else to drive us home. We put ourselves to bed. These did not feel like out-of-the-ordinary things to have to do. Like all children of heavy drinkers, we developed a particular kind of watchfulness. We learned through experience not to trust. We learned to cope with crisis. And if ever we put ourselves in his way, he would say the most creatively hurtful things. When I became a teenager, he started calling me a slut, which in his special way could be wielded as both an insult and a compliment. It is hard to love an addict. Not only practically difficult in the picking up after them and the handling of those aspects of life they're not able for themselves, but metaphysically hard. It feels like bashing yourself against a wall, not just your head, but your whole self. It makes your heart hard. Caught between endless ultimatums, stop drinking, and radical acceptance, I love you no matter what. The person who loves the addict exhausts and renews their love on a daily basis. I used to push myself to reject him, to walk away, failing each time. I oscillated between caring for the man who was afflicted with this terrible disease and attempting to protect myself from the emotional fallout of having an alcoholic father. It took years of refusing him empathy before I realized that the only person I was hurting was myself. And now, as he lies in this hospital bed, wasted and yellow with sickness, a sickness which he has deliberately and consistently sought out, as his heart and blood and kidney functions are minutely monitored by these machines, I look at him and wonder, how can I love him? How can I save him when I can't even reach him?
Our third writer today, Catherine Ryan Howard, lives in Dublin, is originally from Cork, but arrived here in Berkeley from New York because she had to stop off at the Edgar Awards, where she was on the final short list for Novel of the Year, for Best Novel of the Year, Mystery Writers Association of America. So we're very proud of her for that. It's a good thing. You know, last year, Walter Mosley was here at the book festival. Walter Mosley won this year. So we didn't have the awkward situation of you running into one another. But the nomination is for her second novel, The Liar's Girl. It was also a bestseller, as well as, I'm sorry, I got mixed up in my, I shouldn't improvise off my list here, but The Liar's Girl has gotten wonderful reviews. It has been a bestseller. It is the second of Catherine's novels to come out in the U.S. The first was Distress Signals, and a third is coming out this September. I have my hands on an advanced copy here called Rewind. Catherine's suspense mystery writing is absolutely page-turning, and I love that she sets her work, at least the work that I've read, in Dublin and does not feel as sometimes mystery writers are. I know that there are Irish mystery writers who set their work in America, but not. At least not so far, Catherine, though if she does, I'm sure she'll do a good job. There's that Cape Canaveral one that might come out. Anyway, she will introduce you to her work by reading from Liar's Girl.
So this bridge is about two blocks from my actual home. Like, that's how close to home I stay when I write. So this is just the opening scene. Can everyone hear okay? This is the opening scene of The Liar's Girl. It's 4:17 a.m. on Saturday morning when Jen comes to on a battered couch in a house somewhere in Rathmines, one of those red brick terraces that's been divided into flats, let out to students, and left to rot. He watches as her face betrays her confusion, but she's quick to cover it up. How much does she remember? Perhaps the gang leaving the club on Harcourt Street, one behind the other, pushing their way through the sweaty, drunken crowds, hands gripping the backs of dresses and tugging on the tails of shirts. Maybe she remembers her friend Michelle clutching some guy's arm at the end of it, calling out to her, saying they were moving on to some guy's party, that they could walk there. Whose party, he'd heard her ask. Jack's, came the shouted answer. It was unclear whether or not Jen knew Jack, but she'd followed them anyway. Now she's sitting, slumped, on a sofa in a dark room filled with faces she probably doesn't recognize. The thin straps of her shimmery black dress stand out against her pale, freckled skin, and the makeup around her eyes is smudged and messy. Her lids look heavy. Her head lolls slightly to one side. Someone swears loudly and flicks a switch, filling the room with harsh, burning light. Jen squints, then lifts her head until her eyes reach a single, bare, dusty bulb that hangs from the ceiling. Back down to the floor in front of her, a guy is crawling around on all fours in search of something. She frowns at him. This place is disgusting. The carpet is old and stained. There are broken bits of chips, hairs, and cigarette ash nestled deep in its pile. It hasn't been laid. Instead, the floor is covered with large, loose sections of carpet, ragged and frayed at the edges, with patches of dusty, bare floor showing in between. The couch faces a fireplace that's been blocked off with chipboard, while an area of green paint on the otherwise magnolia chimney breast marks where a mantelpiece once stood. Mismatched chairs, white patio, folding camping accessory, ripped beanbag are ranged in front of it. Another smaller couch is to Jen's left. That's where he sits. The air is thick with smoke and the only window has no curtains or blinds. The bare glass is dripping with tributaries of condensation. He can't wait to leave. Jen is growing uncomfortable. Her brow is furrowed. He watches as she clasps her hands between her thighs and hunches her shoulders. She shifts her weight on the couch. Her gaze fixes on each of the three smokers in turn, studying their faces. Does she know any of them? She turns her head to take in the rest of the room and stops. She's seen them. And then I usually go, dum, dum, dum.
I honestly can't recommend each one of these books enough, you know, and just hearing these little bits again, feeling the depth of emotion, the suspense, I'm very excited to have all these writers here. My first question is, the city of Dublin is celebrating Edna O'Brien this year. They're doing the One City, One Book. They're celebrating the Country Girls trilogy. And the Abbey Theatre has put up a production. And they are celebrating, as they should, the wonderful Edna O'Brien. But Edna O'Brien was not, of course, always celebrated. And her work was not always celebrated in Ireland. And she came of age in an Ireland where she could not legally buy a copy of Ulysses, correct? If I'm right, I mean, there were ways, of course. People got it. But I remember reading that in her memoir. So that's just a preamble to my question. And you can each take your verb. My question is, how has Ireland inspired, incited, or influenced your writing, and you can go anywhere with that.
All right, I'll take it up. just see how we get on. How is it? I'm an Irish writer. That's as obvious to me and as fundamental to me as the fact that I'm left-handed. Okay. And when the question was asked of my generation, you know, a couple of years ago, we used to shy away from the answer and shy away from the acknowledgement of being Irish. But I always found the idea of being an Irish writer hugely enabling. One main reason is it's because uniquely Irish fiction or Irish writing is dominated by.
Is it?
You can hear me better with that one. Okay. Is uniquely dominated by experimental writers. In my trade, fiction is dominated by Flann O'Brien, Samuel Beckett, James Joyce. That's our Mount Rushmore, and their bequest to us, their endowment to us, was to say, go forth and experiment. And I found that hugely enabling. I wanted to be of that. You know, God forgive me for mentioning my own name in the company of these Olympian figures. But I wanted to be of that strain. I wanted to be of that ilk. I wanted to see that recklessness and generosity within myself. So that was the idea of what it was to be an Irish writer for me, was to be experimental, reckless, pioneering, because that was the spinal achievement of Irish writing. If you're talking about, and there's a categorical difference between our great writers and our very good writers, and we have a swathe of very good writers, but we've only three or four great writers. And the difference is that our great writers are our experimental writers. And I found that hugely enabling. And I was happy then to be kind of born into the West of Ireland, come of the West of Ireland, and that's been a continual source of, it's been a foundational source for my work. All my work, I don't set out to write about Lewsburg, but that's the gravity that's in my pen every time I, you know, that's the pull that's in its steering, that's the gravity in my pen every time I lay it down. It just veers off towards Lewsburg. And that's fine. Long may it keep doing that. It's better going there than someplace else. And the reason I think that happens for me is that a lot of my writing is speculative. This is Soul of Bones is a ghost story. Notes from a Coma is a science fiction story. I've written loads of science fiction stories and that. But the one thing they have in common is that they're all kind of set in a place that I know. I know Lewsburg. I know its rites, rhythms, and rituals. I know its roads and its borings and its hills. And once I plant my feet there, that's my standpoint. And after that, anything can happen. So that's the tradition. That's what I see myself as an Irish writer, is to be enabled by this experimental tradition and to work from a place that I know actually something about, which is Lewsburg, this small. So if people are saying, oh, you're not an Irish writer, you're a Lewsburg writer, that's fine. That's fine with me as well. That's fine with me.
You mentioned Edna O'Brien. The other person I always think of in that, not in the prior generation, is Kate O'Brien.
Oh, yes.
And I always, because Kate O'Brien also had her novels banned, one of the impacts of that is that you then have generations not able to read their work and not having access to it. And I think one of the reasons why we have quite a narrow, very often male-dominated canon of great Irish writers is because the women's work wasn't available, and as a result, it wasn't being read. And for me, growing up, I remember turning 18 and reading very pretentiously Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man, and thinking, and being told that it was great, and, you know, in capital letters, and reading it and thinking, this is not me. Am I just not getting this? You know, it was a bit like reading Catcher in the Rye and going, what? You know, I'm thinking, well, maybe I must not be smart enough for this to be the narrative that I aspire to, or the narrative that I recognize as my own life. And then figuring out that actually it just wasn't the narrative of my life, that there were other writers, and very often female writers. And now, oddly, I've written a book which is actually the narrative of my life, because it's a collection of essays, which I'm still kind of mortified by, about me, because Irish people, you know, we don't like to talk about ourselves, except we talk about ourselves endlessly. But the reaction to Notes to Self in Ireland, in the first week it sold 400 copies, and I thought, well, that's everybody then, you know. and then it kept selling, and I couldn't figure out why. And then I started getting emails and letters and cards from people who had read it and who said, oh, this is my story too, and then told me their stories, which are actually very different from my story, but in some way the book resonated with them. And I think the Notes is part of the reason why I wrote it, and the reason why I worked with Tramp Press, who are a small, two-woman Irish independent feminist press, was because it's part of something larger, where we are starting to break silences and tell stories. And not just in terms of the large sense of like an umbrella cultural censorship or cultural silence, but actually the self-censorship that comes out of that. The things that we are we find emotionally difficult, or we're embarrassed about, or we're ashamed of, and we go quiet about them because we think that these are the things that you think, oh, it's just me, it must be just me. But actually, these are the things that connect us. And I think that we read for connection, and I think we write for connection. And so for me, writing this book, and then also the biggest privilege of it has been talking to people who have read it, has been about a new Ireland actually coming into being and being articulated, where we are telling the things, we are saying out loud the things that we have kept quiet about for so long.
I had a lot more practical concerns about Ireland and my work, because when I was growing up, I was reading so much American detective fiction and mysteries and thrillers, and they felt so real and so gritty and authentic to me. I wanted to read that, but set in Ireland, that felt just as real and authentic. And, you know, there was a few male crime writers writing in Ireland, I hear, I don't know, a few of them. But there weren't any women. I remember finding this book that has sadly gone out of print by Gemma O'Connor called Sins of Omission, and it was actually set in Rathmines where that scene takes place. And I probably found that randomly when I was maybe 12 or 13, and I just couldn't believe here was this book. And I will, if anyone can track down a copy, it has one of the greatest twists I have ever come across in crime fiction. So I wanted to take the books that I loved and I wanted to transport them to Ireland, but to do it in a way that was just as believable with the Gardaí and our methods of detection. And it's no easy feat, because I looked up this fact to trot out while I was here, but Ireland is the same size as Indiana. So that's my fun fact. If you had a serial killer, you know, he wouldn't get away with it for very long, really, because he wouldn't have many places to dump the body. So there's challenges to writing serial killer thrillers set in Ireland, but that's half the fun. So for me, that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to bring the literature that I loved alive, but in my own country. And, you know, we were talking about this in an event yesterday. Liz Nugent wrote a fantastic piece for Crime Reads about why there's so many, like, female crime writers in Ireland at the moment. And I'm a bit younger than her, so what she was talking about didn't quite apply to me, but it got me thinking about what was in the headlines when I was growing up, when I started paying attention to headlines, and it was missing women. It was Sophie Tuscan de Plantier, who, if anyone has been listening to the West Cork, but I see lots of heads nodding, yeah. Mm-hmm. I'm from Cork, so that was what I was growing up listening to, supposedly in a country where nothing bad ever happened and we were all very safe. And, you know, I think that's what informs my work, really, when it comes to the connection between... Also, I'm really lazy. I'm never going to go research anywhere else, or, you know, it's all going to be in Ireland.
Although I think the Disney area might be something, be fruitful.
Legally, I can't go down that route, though.
Of course you can't. Of course you can't. Right. The essay that Catherine just referenced, it's the horrors of growing up in 1980s Ireland, I think it was. You'll find it. Yeah. Yeah, it's well worth reading for sure. Emily, as you were speaking, I found myself thinking about, there's a note or a preface at the beginning of your novel about a conversation with your mother about publishing the... I'm sorry, not novel. I misspoke. Excuse me. Your collection. Would you share that? I thought it was so poignant.
Yeah, that's actually only in the American edition. It doesn't exist in the Irish edition.
In that case,
just trying to remember.
If you would.
You want me to read it or just talk about it? My mother had various reactions to me writing a book about my family. And the first was, most people wait until their parents are dead before they do this, Emily. And the second, which fair enough. The second was that she said, the kind of serious version was when she said, I completely understand why you would want to write it. But I have no idea why you would want to publish it. and that when you are writing non-fiction and I decided to just be as completely honest as I could be, that is a risk because you are exposing yourself. But I think, like any other writer, and I'm sure both of the other people on the panel would agree with this, when you are writing, you feel the need to take a risk. And this is maybe what you're talking about in terms of experiment. Like, you feel the need for something to be at stake and to actually allow for vulnerability as part of it. Because that's what a reader recognizes that when they come across it. And also, if you're going to write, you want it to be out in the world. It only becomes complete when someone reads it. In the way that theatre is only a script, is only half of a theatre show. Like, actually, readers are co-creators of meaning as well.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you. And Mike, I'm going to ask you a follow-up on your opening too, and that is about reading those great Irish writers. When was it for you? What were you? Were you reading them as in school when you were young? Was it when you were university? When did you start to think of those men as kindred spirits?
I went to study engineering after my leaving cert. My father died as I was coming up to my leaving cert, and I was the eldest in the family, so I was suddenly had this notion that I was going to look after my family, and I was going to get a vocational job, and I was going to set aside the notion that my whole disposition was towards literature and ideas and things like that. So I went to study electronic engineering, and I found out within 3 hours of it that dude, you haven't, you're in the wrong house altogether. So I came home, and for one year I worked as a gardener. I worked as a gardener in a pharmaceutical company, and I was earning huge money. I was earning the equivalent of about $150 a week, and I used to go to Galway, and I used to come back with a bale of books every week. I used to come back with a bale of books that high, and I don't know what it is about. I'm sure people have this experience. I think A.S. Byatt has written about it, about that ravenous reading that you do in your late teens and early 20s, and when you're eating books. And I could read a book a day. And so that was a hugely important time. And I came across a writer that completely changed my idea of what fiction was and what it could do, because I had been reading the high modernists, Kafka and Joyce and all of that kind of thing. But the one I stumbled across, an American writer called Thomas Pynchon, and he just completely changed my head altogether on that. Like, because the opening pages of V is a barroom brawl, and it's mixed up with Looney Tunes cartoons and everything, and it was obviously done with such brilliance that this was a completely different notion of what art. And I knew what this was about. I knew what all this was about. I really understood it. But even as I understood it, I thought, there isn't a hope in hell that this farm boy from Mayo is ever going to be able to do something like this. And so it was a hugely enabling moment and a hugely frustrating moment at the same time. But Pynchon being Pynchon, he came to my rescue. And a couple of years after I read that book, he published a book called Slow Learner, which is a collection of his juvenilia. And in the introduction to that, he writes an introduction to it. We now know that Pynchon's famously secretive, but he's just famously keeps to himself. He's never been photographed. He has been on The Simpsons twice. He's been on The Simpsons twice with a paper bag on his head, and he's done his own voiceover as well, which I didn't know until recently. But in that essay, he talks about all the misgivings he had as a writer, as a young writer. He talked about all the false starts, all the thieving and copying that he did from other writers. And I remember thinking, Jesus, I could write this. This is my essay. I think if it's good enough for the great man, you know, if this is the sort of false start this great man made, well, I'm halfway there already. And that. So the reading of that essay, and I've passed that essay on to other students, and I know that they find it enabling. So finding that essay and finding his work on that really was a big change in my perception of the fact that this farm boy from the west of Ireland, you know, you might have a chance. You just might be able to do it in that.
That's a great story. Catherine, I found out last night that you once aspired, maybe still aspire, to being an astronaut.
Still, yeah.
Okay.
Oh yeah. It's not too late.
Take us. How did you go from aspiring to space to writing detective fiction?
Yeah, that's a very long story, but I'll just give you the highlights. So I always wanted to be a writer. I work with a photograph on my desk that someone took when I was 8 years old, Christmas morning. And Barbie's magic van, which was the greatest toy ever, is being ignored, and I'm tapping away on the typewriter that I asked Santa to bring. And so we went from a toy typewriter to an electronic typewriter to a laptop and so on, and I just always wanted to write. And I was telling you on the way over, Rosemary, that when I, Mike will kill me, but when I was 16, Mike came to visit my school. We were both babies. It was a very long time ago. And he was the first writer I met in real life. And I thought, oh my God, like someone is actually working as a writer and they're Irish and they're flesh and blood and maybe I can do it too. So I was always writing. I definitely spent a lot more time talking about writing and reading about writing than I did doing actual writing. That was kind of a crucial mistake I was making for a while. And another crucial mistake was that I never found an idea that sustained me past the three or four chapters of, you know, youthful enthusiasm. And because it wasn't happening, I went away and I had adventures. So I went to Disney. I worked in Disney for a while in Florida. I worked in France as a campsite courier, which I had to explain at an event yesterday is a general dog's body, basically. Like you clean, you welcome people, you are on a bike, you're changing gas bottles. It's this whole thing. And I actually ended up writing about Disney. So I started writing about my experience there because it was kind of crazy. And I self-published it. And the reason I self-published it was, first of all, because no one would publish it. But second of all, because I just wanted... I thought if the people who were coming out on the program after me bought it, I could keep myself in the ink cartridges and coffee it was going to take to write the novel. And that was my only goal, because I finally had an idea for this crime novel. And I had tried writing lots of different things. I was working for Penguin at the time in Dublin, and I felt if I wrote sort of what we used to call chick lit, but, you know, I would say women's commercial fiction, that if I wrote that, they'd publish it. But, you know, that was it was so wrong. I can't believe I ever went down that road. But I felt I was too young to write crime, or I didn't know any FBI agents. I had something in my head that you needed to do that. And then I just came across this story in a magazine one day, and I just thought, I want to write about that. And it was like, it was almost like there was an audible click when I started writing Distress Signals, the first book. And when I was writing the other, you know, stories that never came to fruition, I always asked myself, okay, this chapter has to be, let's say, 3,000 words long. What am I possibly going to make happen for the next 3,000 words? And when I started writing Distress Signals, I felt like I couldn't get it down quick enough. And how was I going to fit everything into the next 3,000 words? And that's when I knew I was doing the right thing. As for the astronauts, look, I'm still hoping I will get a call from NASA someday. There'll be one short and they'll want me to go. But I did see a... It's going to happen. Believe in yourself. I did see a space shuttle launch, and I think that might have to do me for... Okay. But it was okay. It was great.
It's always the Irish space program, you know. We, yeah. No.
Emily, you have. It's unusual to be as active and academic as you are, and you are a very active. I mean, you came. You were just in Switzerland, and have. You're going somewhere else, and you're running a really fascinating program, the memory studies, which I'm very interested in hearing. But can you talk a little bit about the, well, however you want to take it, but the being an academic and a writer of personal essays, or being an academic writer and a personal essay writer?
The imposter syndrome is strong with me, let's just say that. Which, you know, you have to say out loud, because apparently that takes away its power. This is the theory. It's funny that you mention the memory studies. So I teach drama at UCD, which is a job that I love, and have over the last 10 years become involved in teaching memory, kind of cultural memory studies. So how do we talk about and represent the past? So I have written as an academic about other people's memoirs. To now have firsthand experience of writing a version of my own, which, and it's not a memoir because I didn't want to write the beginning to end, you know, sense of forward progression. I'm linear narrative. I really wanted something more thematic and more true to life. But I now, it's almost as if I have field work experience in the theory that I have been teaching for all these years. And I'll say like small things, like I will never use the word cathartic really again, in the very simple way that I used to about other people's work. I would say, oh, this memoir is about pain or loss or, and, you know, also happy memoirs apparently exist. But I mean, not that many Irish ones, as we said. But I would talk about kind of difficult things and how writing difficult emotion is cathartic for the writer. And yes, that is true, but I think it's much more complicated than that. And it's messy, and I use the word messy because I think it expresses that sense of, like, everything just happening at the same time. And it is cathartic and is painful. But it is also, because it's writing and creative, it is joyful at the same time. And it is hugely vulnerable and hugely powerful at exactly the same moment for exactly the same reasons. And I love that I love exploring that duality. But it's strange, you know, when it first came out and I was doing a radio program, an arts show, and I had reviewed for them for years, you know, gone to the theater and then come into the studio and said what I thought about the play. And the host was quite uneasy with me having published this book. And before we went on air, he kept saying, I would never publish a book like this. Why did you do this? And I was like, well, did anybody ask you to publish a book like this? I wish I had had actually that response. That was what I was thinking, but it was not what I was saying. And he asked me on air, he said, you know, why would you do this as an academic? Why would you jeopardize the professional career that you have by publishing a collection of essays about, the first one is about my dad's alcoholism, but the rest of the collection includes me talking about the years I spent trying to have children and not being able to, and other kind of essays about around my body and also around my job and as a professional woman. And he saw this as a threat to my other self. And I find that really strange, as if I have two personalities. I just think I am the same person. The person who writes about equality and feminism and bodies in Irish theatre now writes about those things just in relation to my own body. There is a continuity of self and of voice. And so in some ways it's been difficult, in other ways it's totally normal. I have to say as well, my students have started reading this book and the publishers were fantastic. They published it in July when we would not be during term time. Because the idea of standing up and lecturing 300 kids who may or may not have read me talking about having periods was not a great idea. But they have, and they have, my students have started coming up to me at the end of classes and I wonder if you have this as well, teaching, and during office hours and saying, we read your book, or I read your book, and I'm like, okay, and they went like, I love it, and then they run out the door as fast as possible. So it has created lots of lovely moments.
That's great, and I imagine it'd be a little bit scary sometimes to have the analytical and critical mind. I write, it must stifle you sometimes.
You can't switch it off. It's really hard, and you have to stop.
Yes.
But again, like, I'm assuming for any writer, you have to try and turn that voice off because it is paralyzing.
Yes, yes. Tell us a little bit more, because both you and Mike were initially published by the wonderful Tramp Press, and I'd love to hear both of you talk about them, but you were invited to write the novel. Why am I calling it a novel? I know better. The memoir, sorry.
Yeah, I was. For me, it's like my dream story. I wrote the first essay about my dad, and I wrote it. He was sick in 2013. Oh, sorry, I forgot to tell you, he's still alive. He made it. Damn. The happy ending. Yeah, I know. And actually, I always think academics would make terrible crime writers because, you know, we give away like the ending at the beginning. Yeah, sorry. I should have prefaced it with the he's still going strong, annoyingly. So I wrote it about him and largely to get it out of my own head. And like Catherine, I could not get it onto the page fast enough. It poured out of me. But I never intended to publish it. And I printed off the pages and I put them in a drawer. And then my partner, who is a more thorough tidier than I am, came across them one day and did what he shouldn't have done, which is start reading. And I'm so glad that he did. And he said, you know, this is better than your academic stuff, is what he actually said. And he said, you should do something with it and think about publishing it. So Tramp Press only publish fiction. They publish, you know, giants like Mike. So I think Soda Bones is out at that point. And I sent it to Lisa Cohen, who is one of the founders, and she said, we only publish fiction. And I went, no, I know, because I'm not asking you to publish it. I just would really like an honest answer as to whether it's any good at all. And she said, okay, I'll read it, but we don't publish nonfiction. I was like, no, I know. And so then a couple of months go past, and I'm thinking, oh, it must have been really terrible. She hasn't got back to me. And then, you know, we met up, and Sarah Davis Goff, the other Tramp person, came along, and we had lunch, and they said, we'd really like you to do a book. And I said, but you don't publish nonfiction. And they said, yeah, we are going to break the rules. And what they could see, actually, and is highly relevant to being here, is that they could see that nonfiction, particularly collections by women in America, had become this enormously important political genre. And it wasn't being done in Ireland. And they are groundbreaking publishers. One of the other things they do is they publish voices from the archives. So they publish every year one and they've been novels or short stories from female writers who have not got the kind of attention or readership that in their own time that they deserve. And so they have this kind of pioneering view to what is missing in Irish publishing and what do Irish readers need. And I think that segues quite nicely into Mike.
Yeah. Yes.
Thank you. My book finished up eventually with Tramp Press. I'd published three books. I published three books with Jonathan Cape in London, and Cape are a very classy and prestigious publisher. But each of my books had, you know, you can reasonably assume a career trajectory that goes like that. And mine actually went like that. And even though my books were getting very good reviews and were very well received, it's just I was gradually getting a reputation for writing awkward books that publishers couldn't do anything with. So on the third book, which was very well received, and it just dropped clean over the side of a cliff in terms of sales on that. So, and that ended the relationship with Jonathan Cape. And then I wrote a book of short stories that they didn't want to know about, and I wrote a novel that I couldn't sell and everything like that. And I wrote a book of short... Someone then eventually did take up the book of short stories. Lilliput Press, a brilliant publisher in Dublin, took it up. But that, too, disappeared over the side of cliff. So I then entered into a period of about 7 years, where I couldn't... Literally could not give my work away. And all the time I was writing on this book about it, this engineer... And I finished it anyways. I finished it at half two in the morning, and I sent it off to Marianne, my agent, and I got into the car then 8 or 9 hours later, and myself and Maeve went in to hospital, and we became parents. So the next time I lifted my head was 6 months later, and I asked Marianne, how is it going with the book? And she said, Mike, I'm so excited by this book. She says, this is the best thing you've done. She says, but no one wants to publish it. Everyone loves it, but no one wants to publish it. How do you mean? Well, she said, you know, you have this reputation. Here's another McCormick book, awkward as fuck, and it'll get great reviews, and it'll dive over the side of a cliff, and that. And she says, I have a few more publishers to go with it, and that. Got back to her later, and she said, anyways, I still don't know how many publishers turned it down. She won't tell me. She assures me it'll do me no good knowing it. I do know that a couple of men brought the book to, a couple of editors brought the book to acquisitions meetings and tried to make cases for it. And publishers have access to this database called Nielsen things. And they see your figures, and that's it. Once they look at my figures, game over. That's it. So I had nowhere to go. But in the meantime, since I'd started sending the book out first to now this point, Tramp Press had published three books. And we suddenly said, they're really strange. They only publish three books a year, and yet they're getting them reviewed in The Guardian and The Observer, and they're getting them here, there, and everywhere. Let's go to and send it to them. So sent the book to them, and they contacted me very quickly afterwards and says, we're coming to Galway. We'd like to talk to you about your novel. And they came to Galway. They brought me out to a restaurant. They bought me a bowl of soup. And they they spoke about the book for 10 minutes. And I knew immediately that the book had found its proper home. And I was talking to Catherine there earlier, because we both have... I've had a small independent publisher, and I think Catherine, you was kind of an independent publisher as well on that. And it's about books falling into the right hands and following passionate people who'll get behind them. I was with a major publisher, and it was a difficult experience. Now I'm with the smallest publisher in the world, and they do more work for you. Anyways, they sat, they talked about the book, they completely understood it. Everything that every other publisher had pissed, moaned, and whined about, they had seen as an asset. They loved the experimental aspect of it, all the quiet domesticity of it, the whole engineering thing. No, we can sell that. Sarah Goff, I can sell the arse out of that, she says. So they were very, very brave and enthusiastic and just wanted the book, really wanted it passionately. And actually one of the things about it was that they had great faith in the book, but they had actually great faith in readership. And this was the other part of the gamble that I hadn't. This is, we know there's an audience out there for this book. This is one of the biggest things that the book industry does, is it completely underestimates what readers will go for. And she says, I'm absolutely adamant that there's a readership out there for this book. And you sold, what, 400 in a week of that? Jesus, I would have never thought that, you know, Soul of Bones would sell anything remotely like what it has done of that. I thought it would sell 1,000, 2,000 copies, and the usual thing, McCormick has written an odd book, again, and that. But no, it became something a lot bigger than that. And it's all down to this, I don't know, Tramp Press, they're two young women in their early 30s when I met them and that, and they don't have a stick of furniture or a table or a door or anything. They have no office. All they have is the document that they're working on. They don't even meet up every day. They open some sort of a chat thread and talk across the city to each other and that. And I was asking them shortly after Solar Bones made a few bob for them and that. I says, you'd get a... I said, you're going to get an office now and that. And their answer was just brilliant. They says, no, we've researched that and we've thought about it. And she says, you're thinking now as a man. First thing you do is when you get a bit of money is you stake out your turf. You stake out your turf and you put a desk in it and a secretary in it and that. I said, well, I hadn't gotten that far with my imagination. And they said, no, actually, we like being able to move around and we like being able to down tools and pick them up wherever we are and that. We like the notion that Tramp Press is wherever we are and that. And so that's the... I don't know, has it changed? Has it changed?
No. I think they're amazingly mobile, physically and mentally, yeah, and culturally. And they are really... They're so passionate about the books that they publish. They published... that's what they said. They said, we will publish the shit out of your book, right? which I love, you know? And that is it. I would not have written this book without Tramp Press. You know, from a practical point of view, they commissioned it. But also, just, I was writing for them. It was so enabling. Yeah. So enabling to know that I was writing for people who would come back with... And I remember Lisa saying it to me, because Lisa's from a part of the world which is very close to where Mike lives. And Lisa saying, oh, it's brilliant because you can read Mike's book and I know the landscape that he's talking about. You know, and that sense of not having to, as a writer, not having to explain yourself or translate yourself across some kind of divide. Because actually, as well, they are then going to do that work for you to bring your book. And when I said, oh, even to close friends, I said, so I'm publishing a non-academic book. And they went, oh, great, what is it? And I said, oh, it's a collection of essays. And they went, ooh, you know. And the book is now in multiple kind of foreign editions, including the US edition, which is coming out, and in a few weeks. But the Tramp edition is the only one that is brave enough to say essays on the cover. All the other publishers have taken essays off the cover because they think it will be off-putting to readers. And Tramp are like, no, no, readers are smarter than that. And I think that's really inspiring.
Emily makes a really important point, a point that I never tire banging on about. And it's about how, as I say, I published 3 books with British publishers. And I used to find myself sitting in a room in Vauxhall, in the Random House building in Vauxhall, and inevitably gone through an edit with someone, you know, called Gwendolyn or
Imogen, often, yeah.
And they're down from Oxford to Cambridge, and that. And you find yourself falling into a translation mode. It is so. I wouldn't have believed this experience had I not then gone on to publish 2 books with Irish editors, and I had a taste of it at Lilliput, where I met a young editor called Frances Dunn from Cork, a brilliant woman, and I was amazed at how little I had to explain to her in that, and I was amazed at how little kind of she understood every nuance. But then it was, and then again, it was of a different order as well when I spoke to Lisa Cohn, because Lisa is literally about 20 or 30 miles over the road from where Solar Bones is set, and she knows that, you know, there's, and even if she doesn't know, her old fella know, there's a word in the book called Mairn, and she said, I don't know that. And I says, ring up your father. You know what it means. She rang up her father, and her father says, yeah. He says, I know it is the division between 2 holdings. Many a row and an argument has broken out between neighbours and it and that. So she just, this was the kind of, again, I've always had the suspicion that British publishers were both enabling and disabling in Ireland, they wanted things that they could understand, and they didn't want the awkward things that they couldn't understand. And I think sometimes we accommodated them as well. I think it's a longer argument, and maybe not for here for today, but I'm keen on that point that Emily brought up, and particularly the word translation that she used in that.
Catherine, are you asked to translate to make things more accessible to American and or English authors? And also, just while you also have an unusual publishing experience. You are with a brand new, bold publisher.
A baby publisher,
So tell us about them. And
okay, so first of all, on the translation, I mean, my lead publisher is in London, but my editor is actually originally from Waterford. Oh. So I kind of snuck in there, you know. So she doesn't really ask too much of me that, you know, I mean, to be fair, crime fiction, I am trying to appeal to a broad audience. So I do like to have, I mean, I write it as I believe it is in reality, and I don't take any sort of, if there's something in there that I don't think people outside of Ireland will know, I don't really care, I leave it in there. What's fascinating to me is what happens to the book, and I have to be very careful what I say here, before it goes to American audiences. So
don't be careful. Don't be careful.
Right. So the main thing is swearing. So all the swearing has to, nearly all the swearing has to come out. Yep. Yeah. And if you don't, I know you want swearing, but let me tell you, most readers here do not. And I've had many reviews, you know, on Amazon and stuff that say, you know, I got to the first Lord's name and I threw it in the bin. They're mad for throwing books in the bin on Amazon. And what's really funny is I just went through, like, because I don't mind. I mean, I think it's quite funny that people are more than willing to read about, like, a woman being viciously murdered, but if I say Jesus Christ, they're like, oh, this is, you know, awful. But what's really funny is a couple of weeks ago, I was going through Rewind, which is out in September, looking for my sins, and I just changed. Like, if it doesn't matter, I'm just, you know, I'm very easygoing. I just take it out. But I sanitized it language-wise, and then I sent it off. And then I just, as soon as I had sent it, I realized I'd left a cunt in the book. So I was like, that was by a mile, like the worst thing in the book, and I forgot to take it. Enjoy Rewind, but yeah. So my publishing story here is really, I think, a lovely one because. So I got my deal in the UK and I could not get arrested here. Like, no one would pick up the book in the States. And this was my first book, Distress Signals. And then one day my agent rang and she told me I couldn't get arrested. Like, what she said to me is, yeah, they all liked it, but no one loved it, sort of thing. You know, she's very honest with me. So she said, we have this offer from this little company called Blackstone. Now, Blackstone are not a little company. They've been in the audiobook business for 30 years. Family-owned business, started in a garage, making, you know, audiobooks to cassette tapes. They're now based in Ashland in Oregon. And everyone who works for the company has been there for like 20... I met them for the first time last week, so I'm just like in love with them all. You know, it's still fresh love. I just think they're fabulous people. And they took me on. And I think they didn't know what they were quite getting, and I certainly didn't know what I was getting. They had just started their publishing arm, and I was one of their first acquisitions. Wow. And that was 2015, and last week we were all at the Edgars together. So I just think, and they have done a major, and they've just signed me for 6 more books, which I'm trying not to think about, because thank you. If anyone has any plots they are not using, I need about 5 of them. And they just stole Meg Gardner, Steve Hamilton, and a third author from Penguin Random House. And the thing that all my friends were very interested in was that the press release about it said that each author had a career best payday. So they're just an incredible publisher. They give their authors. I mean, I think authors should be given limited creative control, to be honest, over covers and things like that. But we're so involved, and it's just an entirely different experience because they don't know how things are done. So there's no restraints. You know, if they have an idea, they go and do it. Whereas in the UK, it would be like, well, that's not how it's, you know, been done. And things are very strict and traditional. So I just think it's so fantastic that, you know, they took a chance on me, and I took a chance. No one else was looking to take, but I did take a chance on them. And, you know, we just had such a great week last week, and everything is going so well for them and for me with them. So I'm out over here.
those are great publishing stories. It's really nice to hear them. And, you know, if you have been coming to the Bay Area Book Festival and coming to the Irish panel, 3 years ago, we had Colin Barrett and Paul Murray and John Toomey, and it just happened to turn out to be an all-male panel. And I asked them to tell us. I hear there were women writing in Ireland, but they brought up Tramp Press. I mean, that's when I first heard about it. And the Bay Area Book Festival is another example of faith in readers, and you've got a room full of them here. And I want to give them a chance now to ask you questions, and Betsy is going to ask you, if you have a question, if you would stand up and walk over to this side of the room, because we want to use a microphone. We want to make sure that people can hear the questions. Am I going to give you my microphone? Okay, here we go. So who would like to ask a question?
Hello. I was wondering about form, Mike, in particular, and how this form emerged. Was it part of the story itself? It just kind of took over and told you how to tell it? Or did the form come before the content?
Thank you. The form, she's speaking specifically about the fact that the book is a single, unbroken outpour. There's no full stops, and the only punctuation marks in the book are commas and paragraphs. And so One of the things that I've written three or four books, and I think it's reasonable to say that I had a reputation for writing fairly accurately tuned sentences, and that some of them almost forensically tightened, and that. And I was happy to be that in some ways, but I was very aware that something essential about the messiness and schlobberiness of life was falling outside the finical regard of these sentences. So I kept thinking, how I've always wanted to write a book that sort of embraced life and that, and how do you go about it? Well, there's one way. The big way you can go about it is write a big book, okay? And 600 or 700 pages. Imagine you're a 19th century writer and you take on something like Middlemarch or something like that, or, you know, something like DeLillo's Underworld or something like that. Now, I don't have those. There's no use codding myself. I don't have those long skeins of rhythms to build a book like that. But I was thinking, I don't write a big book. How about I write a big sentence and see how it goes? And I because of my 20s, I spend so much time with visual artists. An awful lot of my work starts with a visual prompt. And the visual prompt at the beginning of this book was right at the beginning of this book was this man in the middle of the day blundering around his own kitchen, and him blundering around in his own kitchen on the Angelus bell, talking to himself and reaffirming his name all over and over again. And it kind of, why? Who is he? What's he doing? Why the hell isn't he at work? And it gradually came to me then, I knew then what he was, okay? And then the very thing that he was, that he's a ghost, and then the very thing that he was, that defined the form. I think it really came to me that a ghost would have nothing to do with a full stop. A ghost would balk at a full stop. A ghost would seek an ongoing continuance. And so that defined the form, that image, that discovery about the book defined the form. And then I was able to draw on I had an exercise that I used to set myself 10 years ago. Every time I sat down at my computer, I would write for half an hour, and I would write anything, whatever came into my head. And the only thing it had to do is it had to transition smoothly from whatever it was I was writing yesterday, and it had to be continuous, because I was interested in the journey. So I have this other manuscript. It's about 300 to 400 pages long, and it's 300 to 400 pages of nonsense, but it's continuous rhythmic nonsense. And that's I was able to draw on that exercise to get the form. And people talk about Solar Bones as an experimental novel, and they always talk about the form. But I'm much more keen on the notion that thematically, it's much more of an experiment. I mean, this is a novel about a middle-class man who has no worries, who loves his wife, who loves his job. Try and make a novel out of that. Try and sell that to Hollywood. I always thought that was the more challenging aspect of the novel.
A question for Catherine. What mystery writers do you admire, and do you like Denise Mina?
I really admire Denise Mina. I read very widely, of course, because we've so many amazing Irish female crime writers at the moment. I mean, I could list 20 names just of the ones I know, let alone the ones that are writing. My way into this genre was Patricia Cornwell and Harlan Coben and Michael Connelly. But right now, I'm really excited about what's coming out of Ireland. And, of course, Liz Nugent, I'm sure she was here last year. Love her books. And we also have Dervla McTiernan, who lives in Perth, but is from Ireland, and she's written, her debut was called The Rune, which I think was published here, and I thought that was a fantastic, fantastic book as well. What I really like as a reader is the same thing that I'm trying to create as a writer, which is I hate that in certain circles genre is a dirty word. Like, I absolutely want a crime novel, and I want it to be really well written, but I want it to push against the parameters of what we consider a crime novel. So something that's kind of new and fresh. Adrian McKinty has a very big book coming out soon called The Chain. So he's left his Sean Duffy series and he's written this incredibly... It's just one of those ideas where you think, God damn him, because I wish I'd come up with it. So the concept is someone has kidnapped your child and the only way to save them is to kidnap someone else's child and replace them. Just brilliant. And, of course, Tana French. I just adore Tana French. The first one, In the Woods, and Broken Harbour are actually my two favourites. So I hope that helped.
I'm not sure exactly how to word this question, but recently I read a book. I really like Murakami's books, and in a book club I had them read his books. And what I like about reading from authors from different cultures is how relatable we are. You know, we all have breakfast. We all go for beers. And she was really disappointed that... that it wasn't all about the other culture. So I'm just wondering about, do you feel pressured to put your culture in or take it out?
I mean, I have been asked to add stuff, to sort of add more Dublin, to add more Dublin, basically, in terms of setting and description and things like that. But... again, like, I am trying to reach a broad readership, and I will never bend things like dialogue. I will never bend things that are, you know, undeniably Irish. But, you know, I like to think that if an American reader picks up one of my books, they're visiting Dublin or they're visiting Cork come September. You know, so I hope they feel that they have been to the country and they've, you know, got a taste of our... you know, breakfast and whatever else we're up to.
I was a bit concerned about that in relation to publishing this outside of Ireland. One of the kind of darker things that I talk about in the book is that when I had a really long, drawn-out miscarriage, I was caught up in, at that time, Ireland's anti-abortion laws, and which made it impossible, in fact, illegal, for the midwives to tell me that the baby had died. And I wondered, would that be interpretable to people outside of Ireland because of that, and which is one of the reasons why I have written that forward for the American edition, so that there is some kind of context for reading that story, for understanding that large social structures affect our individual lives, but that is different in different contexts. So that is one way in which the book is very distinctly Irish. One of the great things about publishing it now is that is now out of date. And I think that has been a huge, great yes. change. Yeah. Yes.
This has been just an absolutely wonderful conversation. All of our writers have additional events. Their books are available for purchase and signing right outside. And before you go, I did mention at the beginning of the panel that Irish Culture Bay Area sponsors the Listowel Los Gatos Writers Week. This year it's happening October 18th to 20th. Mike McCormick here was at the very first in 2016. You can get flyers about last year's, but put it on your calendar. Download the Irish Culture Bay Area app, which you can Google and find. Thank you so much to all of our writers.
We hope you enjoyed this podcast from the Bay Area Book Festival. For more information and podcasts, please go to www.baybookfest.org.